like Pastor Mark was saying, I moved down here 10 years ago. My story tonight is really going to be about how my life was transformed and what brought me to my knees, alcoholism and addiction, and through God's grace, how I've come out on the other side of that through the struggle. It's been, a struggle, to say the least, for my family, and my wife especially. When I was young, when I first started drinking, 16 or so, I didn't think, I'm going to be an alcoholic when I'm 30-something years old, it wasn't something I had planned. The word addiction, it's Latin for enslaved, and it's pretty appropriate. And it's a difficult topic for me to talk about, because it's my story in front of y'all, of course, but just in general, with families, it's not something that really a lot of people want to bring out in the open. Airing your laundry, it's not something that we talk about at family events. My close family knows about it, my mother, father, aunts and uncles, but not like, most of my family, they're not aware of any of this, because it's just not, something that really is fun to talk about either. Situations like that. So anyways, a little family history. My paternal grandfather, he was a police officer for the city of Detroit, 33 years, from 1955 to 87. He was a member of what they call the Big Four, and these guys were basically like attack units, gangbusters. They would take on the hardest cases. So he was a pretty, he was a fair and hard man. He drank. I don't know if I would say he's an alcoholic. I can't, make that estimation. But he was always real fair. My maternal grandmother, she drank pretty heavily as well. So my mother really didn't drink much. My father, on the other hand, my grandfather was an officer. Growing up, feelings weren't really something that was discussed at all. It was business. That's kind of the way he was raised, and that's the way I was raised. Feelings were just something two men didn't discuss at all or anything like that. I just mentioned that because, my family drinking and everything, that, didn't by itself turn me an alcoholic. Ultimately, I made decisions that led me to become that way. But these things, set the foundation for my history. My dad, he always had the saying about a functioning alcoholic. As long as you go to work, bring home money, take care of your family, you can drink. It was pretty common growing up. Alcohol was always at social functions. Alcohol was just kind of like part of, at least I view it as just part of society. I don't know about everyone else. Growing up, we were Catholic, went to catechism every Saturday. And I just remember from a young age, I just was kind of dismissive. I didn't really like going to catechism. I had to miss X-Men and Spider-Man cartoons on Saturday morning. I'd rather stay home. So I kind of always had a skeptical view of religion, kind of young. We go on holidays type of thing. My mother's father, he was a deeply religious man, my Papa Tom. He helped raise me. He was a great man. All the things that I could, describe, like ways, adjectives I could use to describe God, humble, caring, loving, forgiving, all those I could use to describe my Papa Tom as well. He was that kind of man. Grew up not, I guess I better get going kind of quicker. It's going slow. So I always had growing up kind of like these issues of insecurity. I grew up in this alcoholic home. My dad would work a lot, was a mailman. Would stay at the bar a couple hours after work, so I didn't see too much of him. And I always had a resentment towards him for that growing up, for not being present. My Papa Tom was there, fortunately, to give me, this moral compass to kind of direct me growing up. And then, I got into adolescence, started experimenting with alcohol, And right off the bat, red flags, you know, I'd be blackout from drinking. You know, it was probably early warning signs that, hey, you might become an alcoholic if every time you drink, you black out. But, you know, I don't have warnings like that on the outside of the bottle to kind of give you a heads up. So, you know, went on like that. We were out at my grandpa's one day at the lake. He lived on the lake, and was drinking, fishing, and I stepped off the dock to get on the pontoon boat, and I fell between the dock and scraped my leg. Went swimming, didn't think much about it. About 2 weeks later, I had an abscess in my leg, and I was at football practice. The coach was like, you know, why are you hobbling? And I picked up my short, and my leg is about twice the size with this abscess. So he said, all right, you need to get out of here. Go to the hospital. So I go there, and they lance my leg open. And I remember that first time. I was given morphine IV. I was 16. And, you know, immediately this feeling was something that I liked. You know, I didn't really know how to define it, but it felt good to me. And then afterwards, they had to pack my leg. I had to pack it with gauze to let it heal from the inside out for 6 weeks. And got put on a prescription for Vicodin for 2 a day right before I changed the dressing. And kind of developed that, like I said, learned to like it. So I go through my adolescence, experimenting with alcohol. I joined the Marine Corps at 18, went to boot camp. I was there for 3 months, and that'd be the last time didn't have a drink or anything for 3 months. So that would be my longest time at home without anything up until the age of 34, basically. So, you know, from that time on till 34, it was some type of mind-altering substance that I was looking to make me feel different. And, you know, most people, not everyone is an alcoholic, obviously. You know, a lot of people can have a drink and stop when they want to. You know, when they decide to, they don't have to drink anymore. I'm just not that type of person. You know, if we're at a family function and a bottle of wine is out there and they're pouring between several glasses, I'm thinking, why don't I get the whole bottle? Like, who's going to get use out of one glass? That's the way my thinking was. And that's not normal. you know, I'm sure most people don't think that way. But, you know, for people like myself, you know, that's, I guess, the reality that I faced. And I went to the Marine Corps, came back, went to college, and, you know, a lot of my friends that we would drink and things with, they had moved on to harder things. I didn't go that way because of my path, but, I told myself, like, I've got this control over it. You know, I have power over it. They can't stop. What's wrong with them? Why can't they choose to stop like I can? I had that judgmentalness there. So then I graduated pharmacy school and I moved down here to Texas. Wanted to get away. I had been in a long-term relationship that went sour, and from my past as a child, I would like, if dad was drunk, it's more like I learned to run away from things instead of face things. It was an easier way to just kind of mind my business. So, like, when difficult things, I didn't really develop these coping mechanisms growing up that probably people should, you know. So for me, my answer was to avoid the problems. Avoidance, run away, and this, you know, issue, this relationship, it went sour. I moved down here. They had really great sign on bonus to move to the Lufkin Neck Jasper area. And I'm like, well, I'm going to get away from this girlfriend, and I'm going to change my people, places, and things, because now I'm starting a career as a pharmacist. I don't want to live this lifestyle I've been living. I need to, I'm going to have my professional life now. And so I moved down here and, started working 9-to-5 jobs. But it really backfired on me because I was isolated now. Didn't have my family or friends, any support network. And I was by myself, left to my own devices, go to work 9-to-5. And I said, okay, I'm going to reward myself today. I'm going to have a drink after work. And I started off, innocent, I guess you could say. But over the course of time, several years, it became more and more and more. Eventually, probably, so this was about 2014, I met Brittany. And we were 2015. 2014, we were having, she was pregnant, we were gonna have our daughter, so we'd gone back to Michigan to let all our family know. So here we are, and you know, it's a great time, we have a time with my family, we're gonna bring the first granddaughter to our family, and you know, I'm drinking this whole time while I'm there, and partying, and we get back, fly to Houston, and drive back to Lufkin, and I drive out to Jasper where I work, and had been up all day, and driving back home that night, between Jasper and Zavala, I went off the road at like 80 miles an hour, I fell asleep at the wheel. And I flipped the Jeep, I hit a culvert, flipped the Jeep twice, and I should have died, honestly. You know, God was looking out for me that day, he literally, you know, protected me. I came out with a leg lift. And when I came through that, you know, I didn't have any serious breaks or injuries, but I had a big bruise on a contusion on my chest from the seatbelt. And something about that, I went back to my old habits. I went to the doctor, they gave me a prescription for opiates, and it kind of kicked it off for me. I wasn't in the right place mentally, and started seeking out, you know, more after the accident. Eventually, started taking larger and larger amounts of opiates, and you know, I knew what I was doing wasn't right. Our daughter was going to be born soon. I tried several times to stop, was unsuccessful. I didn't have control anymore. I thought I had the willpower, but I didn't. I did not have the power anymore to just quit when I wanted to. I left that job and was going to go work somewhere else. And I knew I needed a, you know, a solution, so I saw a doctor and got put on medication, Suboxone, to treat opioid dependency. And it worked really well for me to clear the cravings, of course, in a way, substituted one thing for another. Eventually, I got off that, but once I got off that, it was back to the alcohol, and then the alcohol, you know, I used that again to change the way I felt. Through all my drinking and drug use, eventually I got in trouble with the Board of Pharmacy, and I had to go before them, and I was trying to manipulate everything around me, you know, trying to minimize what was really happening. I was in denial that I had a problem, and so I tried to minimize the consequences of my actions. So when I went before the board, you know, I told them that I had a never abused anything in my life, wasn't an alcoholic, I was you know, unfortunate victim of the opioid crisis, and I got what I wanted. They didn't send me to an inpatient treatment program, they sent me to an outpatient one where I go twice a week here to ADAC, and I could keep working, you know, and not have to face many consequences, but I mean, that's a pretty big consequence. I had to take drug tests twice a month. But my mind, I was like still in this denial, and I started getting these resentments. I was so resentful at the board for, and my mind was so twisted at this point. I was resentful at them because I thought I should be able to drink like a normal person. Why can't I enjoy beer when I want to do this or do that? It didn't work real well. I wasn't embracing any of it. The treatment, I was still in denial. I still felt like I kept drinking on the weekends. They would test us on a Friday, and if I didn't have to test, I would start drinking on the weekend and then stop on Monday and just try and skirt the system. And that's just, you know, pretty absurd looking at the facts of the matter that I would still continue to drink, but that's just how twisted my mind was. You know, talk about the reward center in the brain. You know, it's usually when you know, food or sex, you get this dopamine that releases to reinforce survival instincts. Well, I hijacked it with the use of alcohol over the course of years and basically saw alcohol as what I needed to survive. And that was the only thing that came to give me any sort of pleasure. And eventually, it got to the point where it was no pleasure at all. It was just, my life is miserable, but I don't know any other way. You know, I would really become a slave to the alcohol at that point. And eventually, I went on a cruise last year, April, and drank a bunch, partied, came back and was drug tested and came up positive. The board told me I had to surrender my license immediately. I had to go into work, resign my position that day, and I was really hard, but I just fell into this hole of self-pity. I don't have a job, I'm supposed to be the male of the house, the man of the household, to provide for my family, yet I can't do any of that. And I just went into this downward spiral of depression, and my drinking became worse than it ever was. I was really hopeless. I stopped caring about anything. Brittany did her best to try and bring me around, and keep me positive. But I was going to do, it didn't matter what anyone was going to do to me or say to me, I was going to find a way to drink. She would hide alcohol, I would find other ways to hide it. I would hide in my vehicle so she wouldn't look there. It got to the point where, we would not leave cash in my wallet or card, so I couldn't buy anything while I was out. Yet I still, I had another account that no one knew about that I would say I was going to an AA meeting. And I would go to the AA meeting and purchase alcohol while I'm at the AA meeting so I could drink. That's just how twisted it became for me. Because it's really all I, that bottom of the bottle was, it really became my God. I worshipped it at the expense of everything else. My health was going down the drain. I say hopeless, I thought I knew the word hopeless before, but this was like hopeless. I didn't care if I died. I had thoughts. I'm not making any money. What if I got in an accident and ran off the road in a tree so my family could get my life insurance claim? These are thoughts that actually went through my head because I was so desperate in my thinking. Fortunately, I went to treatment. It happened in April that it had started, and in July I went to Palmetto Addiction Recovery Center in Louisiana, and I was spiritually bankrupt, emotionally bankrupt, physically, health was poor, my liver enzymes were elevated, I was in shambles. They started detox, about 2 weeks, I was in fog. I started to realize what was happening in my life, what I needed to do, but I really wasn't getting on board with treatment. I had no power. I was powerless over alcohol, and it's like the first step. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. The first step was to do this assignment where you write down these 5 examples of powerlessness and the unmanageability in your life. And when you start to write those things down and see what your actions have done, what the consequences would be, then it really breaks through that denial. And started to realize I needed something new. This is basically our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous Text. And there's a quote in here, they have a section called The Doctor's Opinion, and it says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And so I need to find this power greater than myself. So I'm there, Brittany's at home, taking care of that, and she's by herself. And I'm stuck away in Louisiana for 90 days in treatment. And I'm just thinking this is just something I have to do to get my license back eventually. Not even know if I'm going to stop drinking in my mind. I started working these steps. The first step is just breaking through that denial. I got through that. The second step is came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And of course, if you look at just what I told you, you're like, yeah, your life was pretty insane. Your actions were insane. Your thoughts were insane. So it wasn't too hard to get that step and move on to that one. Uh, third step was, came to believe that a power than my, greater than myself, The third step is, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. That was kind of hard for me. How do I do that, you know? How do I turn my will and my life over? And they had this program there called Celebrate Recovery that they take us to. It's a Christ-centered recovery group. And I remember going there, and our counselors have been telling us, you know, listen to, keep your ears open, people. You don't know who God is going to be speaking to you through. And I kind of dismissed it. When Rick Ford was about to go to Celebrate Recovery, Brittany had called me and told me, you know, that I should embrace this. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to embrace it. You know, I'm going to go there and see what it's all about. So I get there, and we get in the sanctuary, and we start going over the program. And the first thing they had, and I still have it, this blue chip here. It's called this surrender chip. And it's basically a symbol of the day that, you know, you were willing to turn your life over to Christ. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'll pick up one of those chips. What's it going to hurt? So I pick the chip up, go sit back down, and I'm sitting there, and they start playing a song, Lay It All Down. And it says, you know, it says, bring your worry, grief, and shame, all the cause you have, all the, your worry, grief, and pain, all the cause you have for shame, lay it all down at the feet of Jesus. And that song literally, like, changed the way I thought about God, religion, everything. You know, I had been dismissive before. When this song hit me, I was like, you know, I had gone to church all my life and never really felt anything. I just kind of went because it was like, in my mind, a stopgap measure. Like, you know, I'll go to church because if there is a God, I don't want to be on his bad side. I'm gonna believe just in case. You know. And that moment when I was there at Celebrate Recovery, when that happened, I had this feeling overwhelming. Like the warm fuzzy feeling filled my body. I started crying. I realized, you know, I don't have to hold on to this anymore. And from then on, like, my life started changing in positive ways. Started finishing going through the steps. The fourth step is you make a moral inventory of your life. All the people you have harmed, going back to our world, all the people you've harmed, all the resentments you've had, all the fears you had, you write them all down on paper, write down why you had those fears, and what the solution to it is. And it kind of clears house in your life, you know, so you can start fresh. And got that going. And it was really like a freeing experience. Step five, and all these have a biblical comparison, which is pretty neat. All the steps do. They're somehow rooted in the Bible. I'm sorry I'm going, I didn't realize I was going to take this long, and I'm trying to hurry it up. Step five, step four, you write all these things down. Step five, you sit down with the sponsor, and you say everything to them. You confess everything, and you all talk it out. What part of you? Is it your insecurity that you feel this way? Was it fears about something? Your ambition for money or whatnot? What led you to feel all these ways towards all these people and all these things? And a big thing that I got to do was talk about resentment I had to my father and address that. We got to talk to him in a teleconference and treatment and kind of hash out these, you know, resentments I had towards him verbally. Through, you know, not face to face, but, you know, over the phone. And it was really an eye-opening experience because he got to share from his side, you know, things he may have wished he did differently. And I got to share, you know, things that I held resentments for him for, towards him for. And, you know, our relationship is starting to get better because of that. I got out of treatment, and I started paying attention to things. Started paying attention to what people say, and now I see God working in my life in all these different ways, speaking to me through people, all these different ways, like these things that I've begun to see now that I just would have dismissed as coincidence or serendipity before. Some of the things I've experienced, there's just absolutely no way in my mind that this this wasn't God speaking to me. What do you think, when I got out, right when I got out of treatment, my neighbor, he's a pastor, and he knew what was going on with me, he told me, it's doubtful, a quote from an author, he said, it's doubtful that God would bless a man without first wounding him deeply. And I was like, wow, that's that's hitting me right now, you know. And I started living my life by these three models we have in AA, live and let live, easy does it, and first things first. They really help on the road when you're driving, you know, live and let live, and people are driving crazy. I had to get rid of it. I always thought pride was a good thing. And it wasn't, you know, pride in your work and whatnot. And I started realizing that pride, in my case, is not good at all. I started learning about what humility was. I had really no understanding of humility. I came across, this is a plug for you, Pastor Mark, a professor of ethics at Baylor University. He wrote something about, being on virtues and ethics. And he was talking about Ben Franklin. There's a quote in his autobiography about how pride is one of the hardest things to beat down, to get rid of. It just always seems to creep back up. And in the pursuit of humility, it really helps to eliminate the vices of pride. And it talked about envy, self-righteousness, arrogance. It was easier for me to see that than just embracing humility, just instead eliminating these vices of pride. It's a lot easier for me to see this arrogance when I have that, or when I have envy, or when I'm being self-righteous or dominant. And of course, mercy versus grace. All these things I've learned about since then. I'll wrap it up. Trusting in God, really. Before I went on the mission trip, I had a lot of fear about my job, finding a job, because I haven't had one since April of last year. And these fears of economic insecurity really weighing on me. And I would read my devotional all the time about trusting in God, and it was a lot harder for me to just, you know, it's easy to read it. It's harder to trust and really give something up to God. And this search for the job had really been weighing on me instead of trusting that God is going to provide for me. I went on the mission trip for that week, and when I came back, it was like another transformation had happened to me again. And I just was at peace. It's like I had turned it over. Like I had given stuff to God, you know. And literally that Wednesday I got called from someone locally about a job prospect. And then started talking to them about a job. And then literally Monday, another job often opens up. And it's like, what? That is not coincidence. So that's God's grace, how it's worked in my life. I know I didn't talk specifically about certain instances, but why he's taken away from me the desire to drink and use drugs. I'll have 9 months sober on April 4th, and that's only been through the grace of God that's been possible. My sister has had trouble with alcohol and drugs. My mom was married to an alcoholic as a codependent. Since I went through treatment, I would always try and think, how can I fix them? And my counselor told me, all you can do is be a living example of sobriety. So I started doing that. Since then, my sister is now on treatment. She's gotten sober. My mother goes to Al-Anon meetings for her own mental health and support. So instead of being isolated and drinking and on my own in my mind, I've gotten involved in the church, the fellowship of the church, started to make contacts through y'all and build a support network. And now I'm not alone, you know. There's people I can rely on when I'm having troubles, people I can talk to, people I can ask questions to. I have the fellowship of AA and other groups in the community. You know, I'm not in this alone. And that's something that I never would have thought possible before. And the last thing I just want to mention was I was getting my hair cut this morning, and I was talking to my barber, the lady at the salon. She's like, well, you know, how long do you have to go to AA? And I'm like, well, if I want to stay sober for the rest of my life. There's this quote in the big book. It says, we are not cured. What we have is a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that's something that I live and I truly believe. And through helping others and maintaining that spiritual condition,